Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, let's get ready to be inspired! Introducing in the red corner, American Tennis! And introducing in the blue corner, your host for American Tennis, Mr. Chuck Griese! Ladies and gentlemen, time to get in the game.
And hello, good morning, and well, it's lunchtime here, but welcome once again to American Tennis. And again, we are already in our almost 10 years now in American Tennis, and pretty much I've always started out by saying that we try to speak up, say what needs to be said, and say it in the right way. Hey, anytime you criticize something or someone, two things. Never be personal. Stay professional. Don't be personal. Address issues, not people. And you can pretty much say what you want to say. And that's, I try to always teach young people that you know, you need to stand up, say those things that need to be said, get them on the table. Most people are pretty good about talking about other people, but we're not good enough, doggone it, at addressing issues the way we should and trying to sort some problems out. We're waiting around for our leaders also to do a lot of things, and you know, and I know that our leaders are going in five different directions, and usually they take care of the hot issues right away, and some of the stuff stays on the back burner, you know. And, you know, it's the old Stephen Covey, if you've seen The Seven Habits, Highly Effective People. I still try to get my players to read that book that came out in the 80s, Stephen Covey, but he has four things. You have urgent, or not urgent, important, or not important. And I cannot tell you how it has helped as a coach to talk to my players, and then for me over the years to get organized to address urgent and important first, or important and urgent first. Secondly, important but not urgent over those things that are urgent but not important, and then not urgent, not important. It's like free time and those things. But you know, I remember so distinctly reading that book, and it helped me so much. Just plan for teams to do things the long term. I mean, when I had to write my books and do those things, holy cow, was that hard. And a scholar I was not, folks. I always tried. I always said I'm a little bit slow. I'm a slow learner, but I'm dang smart after I learn. I do learn eventually, and I remember most things. But that Stephen Covey book, Seven Habits for Highly Effective People, is still darn good. And so do the things that are important but not urgent, and our world will be a heck of a lot better. Better than the urgent, not important, and where we're always putting up little fires and big fires at the end. So anyhow, the reason I brought that up is because we're going to talk about some things today that are absolutely asking for some changes in the sport. And I don't know how dramatic the title is. I put the next tennis boom will depend on symmetry. And symmetry of the sport, the movement into sport. And the lead in, I put basically about our sport is in the transitional phase in many, many ways. You've heard me over and over and over again over the past 10 years just really talk negatively about the scoring system changes, abbreviated scoring, hybrid scorings, and all these things that are bastardizing our sport and how damaging they are. And I've talked somewhat about the symmetry, but I want to, you know, I ask here, is symmetry between the ball striking and the movement on the court has been lost? Can we regain it? I've addressed this somewhat on programs about the sleeping giants of American tennis, one of them being our older people, our over 60, our senior citizens. And I've always started by saying the game is too dang fast for the senior citizens because most of them are using high-tech rackets that allow them to hit the ball more effortlessly and harder, but the symmetry of the ball striking has overcome the movement. And thus saying this, I've used the analogy that it's like trying to dance a waltz to disco music. It doesn't fit. It's very much out of sync. The problem with a lot of the sports now and the hybridization of them, whether it's arena football, whether it is, NBA basketball, folks, I grew up in Indiana and loved basketball so, so much. I would watch any basketball game, and most of the intrigue for me was understanding. I had some great high school coaches, the great John McLeod, the great Bill Green in Indiana, who won like 6 state championships when they had 600 teams there. But I had these people as great coaches, and they were very much the intriguing part of basketball was all the different sets and the formations and the defenses and things like that. And when they brought the shot clock in the three-point play, they brought them in with the excuse that it would be more exciting for the fans. And some people like it. All right, I absolutely hate what college is tolerable. NBA basketball is awful. When you watch it, the symmetry's been lost. It's all athletics, all athleticism, and the different sets. Even in college, now they throw the ball in under. They try for a layup, or they throw it back out for a three-pointer, and that's about it. In the NBA, I think they've done away with man-to-man defense. So therefore, it used to be the great players who were great shooters but couldn't play defense didn't make it in the NBA. Now it's all athleticism, and it's very boring, to tell you the truth. It used to be exciting to see somebody get a slam dunk, and now it's extremely boring. Three-pointers are extremely boring, and we've lost something there. And go in baseball, juicing baseball when there's too many home runs. When you champion the weak, you weaken the real champions. When you have too many exciting moments, nothing is exciting. Excitement dwindles with each occurrence. Drama intensifies with each denial. As I watch the Australian Open right now, I absolutely love the drama part of a fourth set when someone's up 2-1 and trying to close it out, and the drama of trying to serve out a long game and those things. The scoring system of tennis, it is the drama. It's the first you have it, then you don't, and the long games that break a player down or make a player great. The long games either break a player down or make a player great. It's just awful what we've done to cheapen our sport with the shortened scoring systems. Everybody understands where I'm going with this, but I want to make a point about the symmetry and see if we can go from there. But so about 80% of my practices, and I've got to be one of the luckiest people in the world. So for 44 years, I've been able to work with or coach collegiate teams. And then another 7 years, 51 years total, I've been able to look at this sport of tennis and try as I may to figure out the little nuances and the things that make all the difference between good and great, average and good, and why players with great ball striking never surface and why some players surface with average ball striking. The game is incredibly deep as we get into it, as all of you know. It's incredibly deep game. But as I'm coaching my college team now, about 80% of my time now has been spent on trying to figure out how the players stop making stupid mistakes and how to get them to not beat themselves and how to get them basically not to miss as much as they do. If you're taking a player from, say, 0 to the 100th percentile, players, the ball striking, you know, is different until about the 60th percentile. But then from the 60th to the 90th percentile, we have a huge group of people that pretty much the ball striking is all the same. We have, I've always used this analogy about the ball striking versus your ability to compete. Now, from the 60th to 90th percentile, the ball striking is all about the same, although the 90th percentile people win a lot more, and the 60% people do not. And as a coach, you're always trying to figure out, well, why is my 60% percentile guy not winning, and this guy who's not striking the ball better than he is or she is not winning. Now, the last 10% of the players, yeah, there's a difference. You know, there's a subtle differences between the very, very top players, the top 10 percentile. But there's, as my players argue about this in the van, if they got to play against Nadal or Federer, you know, would they get games and this type of thing? And it's really funny how they now talk about UTRs like that is some golden rule that players with higher UTRs are just better ball strikers and players with less UTRs are not and all this, but it's really just fascinating to listen to them talk about their not understanding that the best college players strike the ball as well as most of the pros, except for the top 70 in the world. Any college player, let's say in the top 50 to 100, strikes the ball just as well. But the analogy I always use with them is I say, look, your tennis game is like building a race car in a garage, and you do everything right, and you've got and end up with an Indianapolis race car that it has the potential to win any race. So on the tennis court, that's what, in practice court, this is what you do. It's like building a great car in the garage. Then you have, as the driver, have to be able to take that race car out, and you have to learn how to drive on small roads with no traffic, then on city streets with more traffic, then on an interstate highway with a lot more traffic, then to maybe a race, dirt track races or smaller races, and it takes a lot of steps to get to the Indianapolis 500 with that great race car. Even, folks, listen to this. Even if you've got the best forehand in the world in practice, even if you've got this great supersonic serve, even if you're in tremendous fitness and tremendous condition, you will wreck that race car. You will fail at a high, high level until you get necessary reps in for your psyche, for your mental state, and for your emotional state. You will not know how to drive that car. Some people learn how to drive and use their skills faster than others. Some do not. So the talent matters. Sure, it matters for the ball striking. It allows you to maybe race in a better race, a higher level race one day. But unless you learn step by step and take care of all those steps, It's not about a supersonic serve or a new hybrid racket or something like that. You have to learn how to play the game of tennis the way, and it's such an intriguing game. If you use traditional scoring, it becomes like a chess match. There, if you watch the Australian Open now, you will see that always the match is won way before the end of the match. Usually there's one or two games that we call war zones that a player will break down another player, and the one player separates themselves, just like a long marathon race. It is not all about just ball striking in the one point here and one point there. So I have been spending 90% of my time as a coach, 80 or 90% of the time, trying to figure out how to get my players to improve faster. I've just had Coach Weber, I think, has just checked on the phone, I think that's his number. But I'll be bringing on this guest or Coach Weber here in a minute or two. But here is the point that I wanted to make. Each player has to go through a progression. And I went around the other day and asked my players, and you can ask, if you're a coach, you can ask your players, how long have they played? So I have a player on my team who's played 11 years, another player 11 years. One player has played 16 years. Okay, since the time they picked up a racket. And one player actually is on the travel team, only started 4 years ago, and he has just got a great disposition for the game, and he's got a great knack for competition. So he's been playing 4 years. So I ask all the players, well, my golly, that's way longer than many of these players that have already been on the pro tour. So are we slow learners, or are we not progressing? Are we working on the wrong thing? Are we just not talented? I said, players don't run out of talent. They usually run out of understanding mentally and emotionally how to use the tools they have. So how do we hybrid this instead of practicing the same way over and over and over again? But 80% of what I'm doing now is I'm trying to figure out how to use this high-tech equipment we have where the ball moves faster than the movement. Vic Braden came to College Park, Maryland when I used to work up there, and Vic Braden had the statistics. He said in the days of the wood racket, for a ball to go across the net and back, it was nearly 4 seconds, 3.9. And his statistic on high-tech rackets now is 2.1. So everything's moving twice as fast. If you watched Coach Weber, if Coach Weber's coming on here, he sent me a great video of Jimmy Connors playing those greatest Jimmy Connors points ever, and he had the old T2000 wood racket. The symmetry of the movement, Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall, all these players that played with wood rackets or non-high-tech rackets, the symmetry of their movement and their ball striking was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful, and the points themselves brought drama and suspense to everything. The high-tech rackets, and if I hear one more time, serve plus one, or first strike tennis and these things, I'd really get upset with the players because they try to imitate that stuff and they never learn the penultimate thinking. Okay, so penultimate thinking. Penultimate means next to the last. Great players are always constructing points next to the last shot. Even when you're bouncing a ball over the fence, a good player is looking for the ball to come back. Everything is penultimate thinking. So the brief, quick history, and I'll bring Coach Weber on here, but the very brief, quick history, everyone has to understand about 1980 when the high-tech rackets came in, the Prince rackets. From 1980 to 1990, nobody knew how to use them. Everybody was still teaching square stances, very old wood racket technique, and so the symmetry pretty much stayed the same. You got a little bit of an advantage on return of serve, I think, more than anything. So not really on the serve, not as far as speed, but it was just more forgiving on volleys. But about somewhere around 1990 to 95, people started talking about the first strike tennis because the players started learning how to gain control of the first two balls. And then tennis, I remember, got very, very boring for me as a coach. It was bam, bam, bam. I go, oh, boy, here we go. Three-point shots and slam dunk. There's not going to be any strategy left. I went and saw the great Tut Bartson, who's passed away now, but at TCU. I talked to him actually out at Kalamazoo one year, and I said, what do you look for? He said he would use dead balls a lot at practice to get players to have more symmetry. They'd be able to learn how to keep the ball in the court. I said, okay. That got me thinking a lot about that. And then, of course, Paul Wardlaw, with his great directionals teaching, he had sent me a letter and said he had written my first book about, he saw where I talked about changing direction versus not changing direction. And he introduced me to his directionals, and people have used those now for years. And that has helped. But also the movement, the lower body kinetics movement now, the three or five-step movement. A guy named Jeff Moore, I think, was coaching at the I'll give him credit. I heard him talking one time. He was coaching women at the University of Texas about every ball you can get to 1, 3, or 5 steps. And that's really helped. So what I'm saying, after 1990, people learned how to move better on the tennis court. And so the symmetry, if you learn how to move when you were younger, the symmetry came back a lot, but not for the old people, not for the old people who had been using the wood rackets. So really the decline started when the technology, the ball striking, started overcoming the movement. What happened was you have three things. You have the ball, the court, and the racket. And I hated high-tech rackets because I saw that things became more easy to pick up but easy to put down as well. I saw people not be in love with the dopamine rush that they used to get from this ball striking. I saw kids immediately they didn't go to the backboard anymore. I'm going to bring in this. I think this is Coach Weber. Hello, is this Coach Weber or hello? Is Coach Creasy on the?
It's Coach Weber. Right here. That's Coach Weber. I've been coaching.
Coach Weber?
I've been coaching. Yes, it is.
No, this isn't. I think this is someone else. Who's this, please? Hello?
My name's Billy. My name's Billy.
Hi, Coach.
We've been playing tennis in Alabama. For 40 years right there, mostly on the side of a mountain there. But all the ball striking stuff that I believe is wrong. I don't believe that's accurate right there that we're talking about right now, because we're talking about 2022, and the dynamic of the ball is different, and it's not the same that it used to be, so you don't have to swing quite the same way. That's why women players are doing such a wonderful job there. Because it is different, and it's balls faster, right? You can hit it high, and the racket is different.
Right.
So all the 1960s technology and the language is stupid, and it's wasted time. That's all I'm going to say. That's what I say right
now. No, I love hearing that, and I 100% agree. I 100% agree, Coach, that it helped women's tennis. Because women's tennis,
the shoes,
it brought the ball striking up.
The nets are tighter. Everything's different. So if you try to apply those same set of circumstances that you did in the 60s, even the 70s, right? Even the 70s, and you try to apply them now, it's math that's wrong, right? Today's style is faster. The athletes are better. Everything's better. Everything's different. So you got to throw everything out the window, man, and you got to watch a little bit, and you got to watch these players and watch them use this equipment now, and you have to adjust to that. So anybody that has come, even from the 2000s, right, even from then, it's wrong. Everything is wrong. You have to use your eye, and you actually have to watch and adjust them. And I think a lot of these old coaches don't do it. I think they don't do it, and they stick to their old ways. So that's what I think.
No, I appreciate that. So you believe that today's tennis, do you think it's okay? I look, younger people are picking this up and playing, but would you agree with me that the younger players miss more balls than they've ever missed? The ball striking is great, but they miss a lot of balls.
Yeah. No, I do.
Would you agree?
I do. But here's why. So, yes, they miss more balls. But why do they miss more balls? So you can't end the thought with they miss more balls, right? Yes, they do. Why? They're faster and they're in much more sharper angles than they ever were. Well, why is that? So that's what is really to examine, is how come somebody can hit a ball like that where these kids are missing these balls like they've never, you know, that's why it is. It's not old coaching techniques and all that nonsense. It really isn't. It really isn't. It's really understanding what we have here in tennis today. Today, all the stuff that makes up tennis today. Why is that person able to hit a ball like that over and over? Not that particular person, but over and over, you know, person. You know, why can they do that? Why can they do that? They can do that for X reasons, right? Those are the things to examine. So I think we're looking at the wrong stuff, man.
What would you do with senior citizens, getting them back into tennis instead of playing pickleball? Can you explain that phenomenon a little bit? What's your thoughts on that?
Absolutely not. Keep them playing pickleball. There's no way.
So you don't think they should come back and play tennis?
No, they'll get hurt. Okay. They'll get a ball in the eye or something, or in the ball seat. They'll grab boom right there in the ball seat. That'll cost them $2,000.
I agree with you. Get hurt now. I'd get pulled muscles. I'd get a pulled hamstring in a hurry if I had to play full speed tennis right now. What would you think, Coach? Okay, would you agree that the racket, the ball, and the court are the three dimensions there now? When they changed the racket,
You missed one.
What's the fourth?
You missed one, the athlete. You missed one, the athlete.
Okay, we still have a general public. Maybe we have better athletes now. Everything, that's sort of a subjective thing. You know, but you have to be a better athlete to cover the court. But with the dimensions, not the physical dimensions of the sport is the ball, the racket, and the court. What would you think, and I do this at practices all the time, if you made the court, let's say, more narrow,
it's a racket.
Okay.
You know it is.
Well, yeah. if you add a more narrow court, let's say instead of 27 feet wide, let's say you make it 23 feet wide, and let's put the net up to 3'9" instead of 3'6" and make it all the way across. Make the net higher. Would that slow the game down a little bit and make the rallies longer? Because you can't, Coach.
Of course it would, but
women's
why would
tennis
you do that?
Is. Go,
why would
go,
you do
excuse
that?
Me, Coach.
Why?
And why?
Yes. It,
okay.
Yes, it would make
longer
it
points.
More difficult.
Longer points.
Why?
Longer points.
So what?
More interesting points.
Yeah, so what? There's no reference point to history.
Okay.
Right? So
all right.
The fact that we're getting better.
How about?
Is awesome.
How about smaller people now, who have good hand-eye coordination to try to play? Schwartzman is really.
Are you talking about midgets?
Smaller people? No, I'm not. I'm just talking about people who are 5'8". Okay, Rod Laver, Ken Rosewall, Schwartzman. These smaller guys, with the way tennis is being played now, it pretty much eliminates that population, doesn't it? The way the ball travels so fast.
Not really, man. That's a really hard math calculation, right? So you can't shrink people, right? The court's going to be the same. And why do you think the taller players have succeeded lately? Why do you think
that
is?
Well, they have.
There's a physics
go ahead,
reason
Coach.
For that, right?
Yep.
There's a physics reason. It's physics, man.
Okay.
They can hit the ball harder. They can reach more. They can, you know, can go side to side more if they're fast, right? So a smaller person, given the same size court, you know, no. Nonsense.
Well, how about, would you agree we need smaller people in the court? Do we want to limit tennis to only people who are 6'2 and above and can hit the ball hard? Do we want to limit tennis to that in one style of game?
Why would we do that? I'd love to see a 7-footer. You know, but they can't travel side to side, so, you know, it doesn't
matter. Well, small people can't travel up and back. Small people can't come into the net.
That's exactly right. A 7-footer can't do that. They just can't travel as fast, right?
Well, I got an idea.
As far as the dynamics of the court are, right, there is a very particular kind of athletic human being size. And it sounds weird to say that, but it's true. And it's cool to see taller guys kind of and women kind of exceed. It's not interesting. Why would you do that?
I would like to have everybody, all kinds of athletes represented. We used to have all kinds of different tall players, short players, smaller players. All of them could succeed, but we're pretty much limiting the population. Hey, let me ask you this, Coach. Okay, what would you think for older players? Okay, they started this green ball deal for kids under 10 or 11 or 12. They started this green ball deal so that basically the ball would travel slower and they would have a chance to pick up the game with good strokes. What would you think if we started using a slower ball instead of going to wood rackets or something or changing the court size? What if they just made a slower ball as well for senior citizens? Do you think that would bring people back?
Who would care about that? I think that we need a faster ball for the professional players. Who cares what a senior citizen wobbling around in their wheelchair or whatever they're doing? Who cares? You know, give them a basketball. I don't care. I don't care what they hit, right? It doesn't matter, right? But the regular folks, the professionals that we like to watch on TV, how about we concentrate on that ball? And maybe that's a red ball, you know, or that one is a little bit faster, man.
Yeah. Well, anyhow, those are great. Coach, I love hearing your ideas, and I really appreciate you tuning in to our program. And so you're still coach. How many years you been coaching?
30 years, and almost all unsuccessfully, really.
If you've helped youngsters, you've been a big success. Your posterity will always be important regardless of your prosperity. You know, so, you know, thanks very, very much for the coaching, but thanks for tuning in. And I love that you have your points of view and have brought them forward. And I'm going to try to continue on the program. But we absolutely respect and I want to thank you for coming on, Coach. Okay, so that's Coach from Alabama over there. And that's, we love that. I love to hear different points of view from some different coaches. I have, you know, my beliefs and different sets of values maybe for how the game should be played. Well, tennis, just like we need a lot of different players playing, we need a lot of different points of view. I do want to go after the senior citizens part a little bit here. I think we do need to rescue some of the people back from pickleball. I don't like pickleball. One of my former colleagues and a great coach, I guess he would never mind if I told J.W. Eisenhower up at NC State, one of the greatest coaches of all time, coaches John Sadry and a lot of championship teams and just a great coach. When he saw the thing about pickleball, he said, well, that'd be like having our PGA players, our great golfers, playing miniature golf or putt-putt and calling it the same. He said, that will not last. And I said, I don't know, Coach. I think the symmetry of pickleball works for senior citizens. The symmetry of regular tennis with these high-tech rackets, and the fastball does not work. The ball striking over has overcome the movement. I know for myself, I wasn't kidding when I said I'd probably pull a hamstring muscle if I tried to play singles now. I can play doubles and cover half the court. I think Ed Crass's one-on-one doubles is fantastic because you can play singles like you play doubles and you use half the court. And I think that's good for senior citizens, but for, I just believe that for singles, it's used a whole court and there's not enough time. So I wanted to move on here. I have to do a quick commercial and then I will be right back. And I want to talk a little bit about kids growing up and what really hooks them on tennis is not the winning or the losing. What really hooks them on tennis is the dopamine rush from the brain. And this is Coach Chuck Creasy. I wanted to remind you that my book, Coaching Tennis, is still out, and you can get it on Amazon. Total Tennis Training has been rejuvenated or reborn, and it has been rated the number 7 bestseller of all coaching tennis books ever written. And Coaching Tennis and Total Tennis Training, number 7, and Coaching Tennis, number 3 of all time. Look on Amazon and get Coaching Tennis by Chuck Creasy. That's K-R-I-E-S-E. And, folks, it's much more than just hitting a tennis ball. You'll learn the physical, the mental, and the emotional strategies, and probably the only place in the world where momentum control tactics have been written. But Coaching Tennis by Chuck Creasy and Total Tennis Training. And I'm back, and I wanted to talk just a little bit about some another thing about how we could have a rebirth in our game. Again, the symmetry is a huge thing. My quick idea here on senior tennis, I wanted to wrap that up. Senior tennis players, look, we need a slower moving ball. They're not going to change the high-tech rackets. The tennis industry have too much control over our governing body right now, and they're going to amp whatever the next supersonic boron fiberglass, whatever they make them out of, super-sized rackets are to make it seem easier for you. And it's easy to strike, but it's still really hard to keep the ball in the court. And I think for youngsters, those high-tech rackets do more damage than you can imagine. With youngsters, I use the old 85-inch rackets or even a wood racket to start out sometime. Or I absolutely have my daughter right now. She plays with the old Pro Staff, Wilson Pro Staff, the old Pete Sampras racket in it. And it's made her strokes very clean. Their strokes are very clean. It's worked out quite well. But that's my thought on the rackets, but the manufacturer's not going to go back and do that. The manufacturers are going to go with the next hot item, and they're going to get us to buy them. And then we go to the tennis court, and for your senior citizens, the game is just moves too fast for us to have an enjoyable experience unless we play doubles and we play on clay or something. But so they're not going to use wood rackets. But how about this? We need a ball called the gold standard, or the gold standard or something like that. And it could be similar to the green ball. But listen to the psychology. That green ball that was put out for young people to practice with, it's a great teaching tool. But they ran into problems when they jammed it, forced it down everybody's throat, and you had to play this green dot ball sport, and then you had to do the orange ball at a certain level, and people are going, come on, are you kidding me? That's like learning to play basketball on a 4-foot goal, then an 8-foot goal, then a 10-foot goal, finally. It's not a bad teaching tool, but it is not what really accelerates the learning. What needs to happen with senior citizens? A senior citizen, if I have an 8-foot goal and a 10-foot basketball goal, and they're side by side, and I played basketball all through my youth, there's no way in the world I'm shooting an 8-foot goal because it's easier. I'm going to shoot it to 10-foot goal and be challenged by it. And what used to be my 17-foot bank shot that I could make all the time has now become a 7-foot bank shot. Okay, that's all right, but I don't want to play with a kiddie goal, and I don't want to play with a kiddie ball. I want to play with the real thing. And that's where we've messed up, but we maybe need a gold standard ball. And our coach who was on earlier, I think we could maybe, I don't know, but there's the ball, there's the court, there's the net, there's the court, which is the dimensions, and the net, there's the racket, and there's the ball. The racket went high tech, the ball stayed the same, the court stayed the same. I don't know, maybe we could have a higher net all the way across, maybe 3'6" all the way across. But the long and the short of it has become, smash mouth tennis, and the symmetry has been lost. I know that maybe younger people can play it. I sure can't anymore. So I wanted to talk, though, a little bit here about the dopamine rush. Watched a movie this last week, The Social Dilemma, and most of you may have seen this. But basically, I just hated watching it because I didn't want to think about high-tech stuff and things during the season. But the dopamine of our children is being hijacked, according to this movie, the dopamine rush to the brain with the cell phones. Well, I have mentioned often that on this radio program that I played tennis as a youngster for three reasons: the dopamine, the adrenaline, and endorphins that I got from the game. Winning was important. I've always liked winning, always hated losing. But the dopamine rush, the adrenaline of competing, and the endorphins from being in shape, that dopamine rush that you feel when you hit a jump shot or hit a great wood bat. Wood bats, aluminum bats. Oh, boy, I can go on forever about how the manufacturers have screwed up our sports. But the what you feel when that hear that crack of the bat, Ben Hogan, Persimmon Woods, I've played with for a lot of years. And I love the feel. I'd rather hit a 200-yard drive with a Ben Hogan Persimmon Wood, hit it on the screws, than a 240-yard drive where technology allowed me to do that. So, but here's the point. The dopamine rush is important. If our youngsters are not getting that same dopamine rush when they hit the ball, they're not going to do it repetitively. They're not going to do it over and over and over again. And I can say in 1980, 81, 82, right in there, players that I was coaching stopped going to the backboard. They no longer went to the backboard for hours and hit on the wall searching for the sweet spot. It was like overnight. And if you put a wood racket in a youngster's hand and say hit on the backboard, they will become addicted to doing it. They will be looking for the dopamine rush. Well, that is an absolute fact. As far as 51 years of coaching, I'll tell you that that dopamine rush and wanting to do it again and again is really matters. Whether it's you're on a driving range and you're hunting for the sweet spot on that golf club, or whether you're in a batting cage and looking for the sweet spot on that bat, or whether you're shooting a jump shot and you're looking to hear that beautiful swish sound as the ball goes through. That dopamine rush is a great, great thing, and that keeps people coming back. And when I talked about our players missing so many balls and not learning how to keep the ball in play, the gentleman, the coach who just called me, you know, he talked about errors versus non-errors. And a lot of people think it's, hey, hit more winners, it's more exciting. But if you've been in coaching for a while, you understand that winners feel like two and they only count one. When you advance, you know, you can hit a winner physically, but errors count two. They only feel like one, but they really count two. That's a very important statement. Players who do not beat themselves are very, 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 very hard to beat. But the player who tries to beat you, if you don't beat yourself, has to almost play perfectly. But most players do not understand that if you're up 30-15, our sport is a game of double jeopardy. If you are up 30-15 and you miss a ball on top of the net, well, the score should have been 40-15. Instead, it's 30-all. That's a two-point swing. That is absolutely a two-point swing. And we have the only sport that has simultaneous offense and defense, other than probably boxing or racquetball or something like this. Racquetball, we keep score by ones. If I miss, the other player gets the point. And in other sports, we have an offense and a defense. So a coach the other day asked me, he says, why do you dislike NOAAD scoring so much? I said, well, it's very simple on the surface to see that the game point is an eight-point swing. And he said, well, what, eight-point swing? I said, yeah. I said, it's very easy to see at 4-4 when somebody makes an unforced error and misses a ball. Or in college, we have that silly let cord rule that if the ball hits the net and comes over, it's an eight-point swing because the person who goes up 5-4 only needs four more. The person who just lost the game needs 12 more. Now, that happens at every level. If you're up 2-1, it either becomes 2-2 or 3-1. It becomes an eight-point swing. If you're 0-0 and a person gets a lucky shot or, unfortunately, lots of shots are taken. I don't want this old different topic, folks, but the cheating is unbelievable in college tennis and junior tennis because when you use NOAAD scoring, it is an eight-point swing on game point. I want to write an article. I'm getting off track here a little bit, but I want to write an article called The Art of the Line Call. What do y'all think about this? The Art of the Line Call. And this is completely satirical or what I what is the term in English? It is an example, a false metaphor, or that I can either teach my players for years and weeks and weeks and weeks to learn how to do a slice backhand so they can keep the ball on the court and work really, really hard to get 8 points up or get the extra game up. Or they can just simple take a line call. Or when the other person takes a line call, you take a line call first. Now, how bad is that if we're going there? I'm thinking about doing a satire on what's easier, what's better. Are there really rules now? Cheaters absolutely do win today in our sport of tennis. Cheaters win. It's that simple. I hate to tell you that, but cheaters win. If you cheat well on game point, you win. I've always said you're in the process of winning or losing every day of your life and has very little to do with the win or loss. Absolutely, we don't want to cheat. When you cheat, there is no honor in that. When you don't win the fair square way, there's no honor in that. But what about losing against somebody that cheats your pants off? It's happening everywhere. And it's happening because the stakes are so, so very big. When you get so much for such a little transaction, all you have to do is make a line call on a serve, then there's an eight-point swing. Players have learned that if they win three NOAAD games instead of 3-3 and being in a big dogfight, they'll win 6-0. That's how simple it is. And it's just very, very bad that we're not teaching our players to honor and respect and love the game more. I'm sorry Coach Weber didn't come on. I wanted to talk a lot about the code. For years and years, it was very simple. We played by the code. It was an honor code. It was a historical code and something that we had used for years and years and years in tennis that made the game a great gentleman's game and a gentlewoman's game, if you want to say. But it was a great game that you honored, and you were honored, you were proud to be a part of, but you would never do something to bring dishonor to it. Now the winning and the losing has taken a precedent. The no-ad scoring has made it to where we have random results. The player who should win and has done all the work and is maybe the better player can easily lose in this format when you have no-ad scoring. And then you add high-tech rackets and big serve, two big shots. A player can go from being the lesser player with two big shots. They don't even have to learn how to play the game of tennis. So, I've been in the game since 1963, and that's nearly 60 years I've been in this den, 59 years. I absolutely love it, and I'm disgusted with some of the things that happen, but I want to move on here to the coaching. So Coach Weber had sent me a video of Jimmy Connors playing and the top best shots that he had ever made and the best points he'd ever played. It was really very, very interesting. I will watch the Australian Open, one of the big opens now, because usually there's great drama and there's so much on the line that there's still a tremendous, tremendous battle that is being staged. It's not just the athleticism of the athletes, but it's the drama. I watched the whole first set of the Cressy kid, Maxime Cressy, and Nadal. And it was short tennis because of the way Cressy was playing. But those were two absolutely contrasting styles, and it was quite interesting to see the little bit of flow. There was pressure shifts in that first set, and then I didn't get to watch even who won. I told my wife, now, that, folks, this is a prediction, but I've seen a lot of tennis that Nadal won 7-6, probably 6-3, 6-2 or something. That's what it looked like. Now, I might be wrong. Maybe Cressy came back and won. And if he did, fine. But I've seen a lot of matches, and I've seen a lot of 7-6, 6-1 type matches, 7-6, 6-3, 6-2 type matches. One player gets their heart broken, the other person gets the momentum, and Nadal is very comfortable with leading. I've even getting back to missing balls or making balls. I'm even have been to the place where I've told my guys, my team. When you're playing tennis, you can teach your youngsters nothing wide or nothing in the net. If they miss, they have to miss long. That's a critical, critical thing. With that, your players need to understand that wider in the net is something they can control. That is a mental error. Long is a physical error. You can forgive physical errors, but wide or in the net is almost always a mental error. They're pressing. They're trying to go for too much. They hit around the opponent instead of constructing the point. So I've often thought if I only had, I don't want this taken in the wrong way, but some kind of a shocker on their leg or something like you do with your dogs. You know, you have in your yard, you have that shock collar on them. But the players, if they would get negative feedback when they missed with these high-tech rackets, they'll slap a ball and they go, oh, I just missed in the net, or oh, I missed wide. And it's really hard to get them to change to where they'll use bigger margins. But if you want to win in tennis, you have to learn to use bigger margins. Missing long is acceptable. There's a bigger thing that I've been trying to figure out, and that's how in the world do I get the players to have a little bit of a dopamine rush when they hit a ball in the court? And if it's, let's say if it's deeper, it's a deep ball and well-placed, they get a really a good dopamine rush like you would with making a basket. No matter whether you shot it with good form or bad form, you get a dopamine rush from making the basket. With the tennis, the players get the dopamine rush, or they used to, off of the racket, but not really. They play with the line. They don't understand the value of making balls. You have to make balls and not beat yourself. So with that, I want to, you know, to cut down your errors, I'm going to give you the tip now, the tip that is a 100-year-old tip almost, from the book Match Play and the Spin of the Ball by Bill Tilden. It was written in the 1920s. I read that book years ago, and the most brilliant part of it, that is, it's subtle, it seems unimportant, but the most brilliant part of that book is he starts out the book in one of the first chapters, and he goes, there are four variables, okay? There's two variables. You either keep the spin, or excuse me, you either keep direction or change direction. You either keep the spin or you reverse the spin of the ball. And he said that's what determines almost all errors. And so I want you to, next time you go out and play tennis, try this one. I only got a couple minutes. I'm going to explain this quickly. But when you're hitting slice back, whenever somebody hits to your backhand, no matter whether it's a slice or a topspin, it's always going to roll with topspin towards you. If you had a slice back where it came from, you kept direction of the ball, but you kept the spin of the ball. That is the easiest. So when people learn how to hit a good slice backhand, it's easy to control a slice back cross court all day long. It's easy to learn how to control. Teach your youngsters how to keep spin and keep direction. Now, the second easiest would be to keep direction but change the spin. That means you're going back where the ball came from, but you're hitting over the ball, but you do have to reverse the spin of the ball. That would be number two. I don't want to say easiest. Number two, most consistent. Now, if you're changing direction of the ball, if you change from a cross court to a slice, down the line, it sounds like it's really hard, but you sort of can use the slice of the ball to not change the slice of the ball and go down the line. Now, this is not a good tactic because you open up court with a weak ball. You used to be able to do that all the time, and it doesn't work now. The hardest shot to do is change a cross court to a down the line. We all know that because you're changing the direction of the ball, the spin of the ball over the high part of the net into the small part of the court, into his in Paul Wartlaw, what he calls an inside angle, an inside angle. So I want you, we need to honor the game. We need to absolutely, folks, to protect the history and the heritage of our great sport, our great game. All of us are in this. And the coach came on. Thank you for your ideas, coach. But remember, we need everybody playing tennis. We need men and we need women. We need young. We need great athletes, not so great athletes. We need older people to all be able to play this great game. I want you to think about what we're doing. And maybe it's as simple as if we could get the symmetry of the ball striking with the movement pretty much the same, and go back to dancing a waltz with waltz music. Now, if you can play disco music and dance disco, fine. Or if you can, you know, rap music and dance the rap, whatever, however that you would dance to that, oh, that's great. If you want to dance faster to faster music, if you can, that's fine. But I think that for the people who play, we need to keep the music and the dance steps in tune. And in sync. So, yeah, a lot to talk about, and I want to thank you all for being on the program and listening today. This is Coach Chuck Creasy. I wanted to remind you that you are in the process of winning or losing every day of your life, and it has very little to do with a win or a loss. Let's bring back American tennis and make it more powerful than any other country's tennis in the whole world. I didn't mean powerful now by hitting bigger. I mean by let's all get behind it and see what we can do to wake up those sleeping giants out there. We'll see you next week on American Tennis, and this is Coach Chuck Creasy.